So what can you do? What can you do realistically, you know, that takes into account what you are about? Well, here is what you can do. Ignore the activists, ignore the revolutionaries. We have to face bullets, we have to face military trials. It doesn't matter really what you do. It doesn't matter if Facebook is going to reveal my information or not. I have to assume that I'm being constantly watched, that I'm being that everything about me is public. It doesn't matter. But what matters is ordinary users who use your products to practice their agency. When you decide that they cannot decide to choose a pseudonym, then you are negating them the right to negotiate their identity. The right to negotiate your identity is, it's not in the Charter of Human Rights, but it's actually essential to most rights. Negotiated identity is very important. I get to choose whether to reveal who I am and how to reveal who I am and decide who I am on my own terms and on my own basis.
A portrait of the activist outside his prison. We came of age with the Second Intifada, took our first real steps out into the world as bombs fell on Baghdad. All around us, fellow Arabs cried over our dead bodies. Northern allies chanted, not in our name. Southern comrades sang, another world is possible. We understood then that the world we'd inherited was dying, and that we were not alone. We strove to understand. Company brochures, press releases from NGOs, official statements. It was never enough. We read everything there was, got involved with translating some things, had arguments about them. Then we set off in every direction. Initiatives in the market, civil society initiatives, initiatives in any space where we found a little freedom. Intellectual projects and economic ones. Development projects and charitable ones. We criticized authorities. Chanted against rules. Cooperated, when possible, with institutions, unions, universities, sometimes even ministries. We sought out our predecessors. Learned from them. Taught them. For the most part, we refused their legacy but respected their experiences. We understood that information technology was the key to shaping the new world and realized how exposed we were to global monopolies. So we opened free and open source software as a condition for the development of society and achieving independence, and as a crucial tool to modernizing the economy and ending its subjugation. We started to campaign, toured all the universities, students lecturing professors. We organized conferences and training programs. We targeted everyone, from middle school IT teachers to engineering students, to judges and journalists. We connected our criticism of the negative effects of intellectual property rights in software with its effect on the pharmaceutical industry and found ourselves engaged with social issues, like the right to healthcare. We connected our criticism of corporate monopolies to criticism of neoliberal globalization and found common ground with a broad spectrum of activists around the world. Technology localization became our top priority. We worked on the Arabization of terminology, translated user interfaces, taught computers the Arabic rules for numbers, spelling, and grammar. We designed fonts, developed software, and built websites. Our interest in localization and language engineering intensified our interest in Arabic language and culture. We connected bloggers across the Arab world and encouraged artists, writers, researchers, and translators to share access to their creative outputs and their archives. Working to support Arabic online content, it wasn't long before we came up against censorship, prosecution, accusations of heresy, and the imprisonment of the word. So we joined ranks with the defenders of freedom of opinion, expression and belief, of press freedom and academic freedom. As we built online networks and political movements, we also set up business that offered solutions, services, and consultancy for local markets. We worked to convince investors to provide finances and persuaded institutions to take on innovative projects. We set up IT labs and technology clubs in Cairo informal neighborhoods and in the villages of the south. We built wireless networks to extend the internet to Egypt's countryside. Then we were invited to share these experiences in sub-Saharan Africa, and so became engaged with networks that worked to establish online connectivity and local language support as economic, cultural, and social rights. When the world noticed us and our story started to interest journalists and became material for research centers, we insisted on our own narratives rather than those being imposed on us. We studied existing narratives and showed their connections to interests and biases that were not ours, and so were invited to speak at conferences in cities south and north. We engaged with reality, tried to change it, influence it, to anticipate and shape it. We were, of course, one of the weaker parties present, but we were present. At every step, we came up against security restrictions, bureaucratic obstacles, rigid institutions, and power imbalances. On every path we walked, our ambitions were severely restricted and our energy wasted on absurdities. We shared this journey with many peers, each in their field. After a decade of anger and dreams, of working and learning, of attempts to reform and adapting to being on the margins, of experiments, demands, and objections, we all arrived at the same point, that the whole world was in crisis and on its way to change, and that unless we engage with these challenges, our societies would be crushed. And from there, we all came to the same inevitable conclusion, that the ruling regime is a fundamental obstacle to society's ability to renew itself and modernize its institutions to be able to engage with challenges ahead. So we were not surprised by the revolution. We had sought it. And we were not surprised that it inspired protest movements in Europe and the US. Were we not inspired by the protests in Seattle and Genoa? Did we not protest together against the war on Iraq? Wasn't our work for change and reform linked to open debates, shared struggles, and virtual communities that brought together comrades from every continent? But then we lost, and everything lost its meaning. And since our defeat, any complex issue raised is immediately trivialized, so that understanding becomes difficult and action impossible. So it becomes that the energy short age is caused by a corrupt employee paid to switch off the main circuit breakers, or it's because of Gaza. And the dollar crisis is because they appointed Abdel Hakim Aimer's nephew, or because of some brotherhood-related currency exchange companies. The authorities have decided. Meaning is dangerous. Defending it is a crime, and its opponents are enemies. Doing things like communicating with the world is an attempt to understand and influence it. Criticizing the status quo and warning against impending crises, engaging in individual or collective action to impact markets or institutions are nothing but harbingers of fourth generation warfare. It's over. We have been defeated, and meaning has been defeated with us. And just as we were in every step affected by the world and affecting it, so was our defeat, both a symptom and cause of a wider war on meaning, a war on the crime of people searching for supernatural public sphere, where they might find intimacy, exchange, communication, even quarrels that allow a common understanding of reality and multiple dreams of alternative worlds. I am in prison because the regime wants to make an example of us. So let us be an example, but of our own choosing. The war on meaning is not yet over. In the rest of the world, let us be an example, not a warning. Let us communicate with the world again, not to send distress signals, nor to cry over ruins of spilled milk, but to draw lessons, summarize experiences, and deepen observations. May it help those struggling in the post-truth era. For me, I gained nothing from a decade of rage except for some simple lessons. Most importantly, that every step of debate and struggle in society is a chance. And a chance to understand, a chance to network, a chance to dream, a chance to plan. Even if things appear simple and indisputable, and we aligned early on with one side of a struggle, or abstained early from it altogether, seizing such opportunities to pursue and produce meaning remains a necessity. Without it, we will never get past defeat. I have learned that the ruling regime is just an obstacle. The real challenges are international in nature, so seizing opportunities for debate becomes even more important when the conflict relates to issues that transcend national borders. Finally, siding with the stronger party is generally not useful. The powerful need nothing from you but to parrot their propaganda. The weak often cause as much trouble as they suffer. Their arguments and discourses are often as brittle as their positions in society and their diminishing chances of safety and survival. Taking their side, therefore, even as an experiment, stimulates deeper reflection, investigation, analysis, and imagination. We were, then we were defeated, and meaning was defeated with us. But we have not perished yet, and meaning has not been killed. Perhaps our defeat was inevitable, but the current chaos that is sweeping the world will sooner or later give birth to a new world, a world that will, of course, be ruled and managed by the victors. But nothing will constrain the strong, nor shape the margins of freedom and justice, nor define spaces of beauty and possibilities for a common life except the weak, who clung to their defense of meaning, even after defeat. Written in Tora Prison, published on 27th of March 2017 in Madamos.